So 9/11 obviously was a very tragic event. And the fact that they were able to identify this young man, Mr. Yarnell was his name, through DNA testing is, there's the number. Among the victims, 1,112 have not been positively identified. Although the city has issued death certificates for all but three of the victims whose certificates were issued by other jurisdictions. Anyway, so they found out this guy's identity through DNA. So that's what I want to talk about. Can we use DNA to prove a biological relationship or for other purposes? Other purposes in halakha. So the first thing I want to kind of reflect on is the 9/11 question, which a lot has been written about it, and just a few kind of issues. During, you can see in the bottom in source number one, there were 15 cases that came to the Beit Din of America of women whose husbands were in the Twin Towers or were killed in the Twin Towers attack. And the question was, can they remarry depending on the type of evidence that they have to prove the that their husbands really had died? Now you might say to yourself, well, of course, if they were there, but we need proof of this stuff. So it's a little bit complicated. So just in general, when it comes to agunot, when the husband goes on a trip and then he never comes back, by the way, it goes in both directions, but it's a lot, halachically, it's a lot simpler because a man marrying more than one woman is only only a cherem. It's not from the Torah for a man to be married. There's no Torah prohibition for a man to be married to two women. Today, we wouldn't necessarily enable Jewish marriages for a man, especially in the Ashkenaz community, wouldn't allow it without a get. But there were cases where women, you know, wives were, so same kind of process, but not necessarily the same level of halachic challenge that came along with it. So when it comes to this issue in general, there's a lot of research that has to be done, because what if the husband is still alive and now you're allowing a woman to get remarried when the husband is still alive? When it comes to like the court proceedings, they'll talk to the witnesses, they'll be very strong, and they'll say, you know, what you're about to do, if you're going to give testimony, just know that your testimony is could mean the difference between a woman legally, halachically remarrying versus being married while her husband is still alive. So because we're more lenient, and I'll explain how we're more lenient in a few ways, we're also more strict at the same time. So where do the leniencies come in? In general, single witnesses aren't usually allowed. Women can't just testify in any case of Jewish law. But when it comes to agunot, women are allowed to, non-Jews are allowed to give testimony, which is going to come up a lot in this topic. And what happened was, you know, if you look here in the bottom, Rav Yonah Ries, who was also involved in Shea University for many years, he was the administrator of Beit Din of America, he was collecting all this potential evidence for a long time from public and private agencies, and they got telephone records, cell phone records, subway records, elevator records, and, of course, DNA testing and dental records. So here are just some of the highlight points of this. So the simplest way to identify if somebody is no longer alive is they're finding their body, right? But the Gemara says, the Mishnah says, that you have to have found the body within 3 days. After 3 days, we're going to assume that the body's decomposed to a point that you can't really identify through kind of an explicit. So that's called, you know, that's what people call like the highest level of identification. Then the next level is called a siman muvhak bioter, which is basically a very explicit type of sign, right, that could be an identifying feature of that person. And many of the commentaries say it has to be fewer than one in 1,000 people would have a similar feature. That's what would turn it into that kind of sign, which is a very strong feature that is unique, you know, a unique feature. And that's automatically accepted. And then the next level is called a siman benoni, which is kind of like a middle level, which isn't accepted or discounted. And if you have a few of these, right, if you have a few of these types of things, then those can be combined. So here are some a dental record, for example, right, like the discussion. The person had something on their tooth or something in their tooth, some kind of, it wasn't like a regular tooth, it was, a hole in their tooth. These are some of the discussions that went on. Is that enough of a unique identifying feature to identify a person's body? So let's say they find a tooth, and then you can verify that with dental records. That could be, on the level of being able to say this person is sane. The tooth matches the person, and that person is no longer alive. So when it comes to DNA, there's a debate. What is DNA? Is DNA the highest level type of symbol or sign, or is it something on a lower level? So if you look in the first point, Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, who's a big posek, still alive, lives in Israel, he's of the opinion that DNA constitutes a siman muvhak bioter, and he says that the chance of error regarding DNA evidence ranges from a billion to one to a quintillion to one. So that's much more than what we said before. Far exceeds the requirement that a siman be shared by less than 1,000 people in order to constitute a siman muvhak. There are other modern day rabbinic authorities in the last 20, 30 years that have agreed to this point. He gives an analogy. His analogy is photographs. So you don't have witnesses that saw this person die, but you have video surveillance, right? Or a photograph. Somebody has a photograph of that, and that was used in cases to help a woman be able to remarry. They used photograph of a missing husband to show that he's dead. That was sufficient evidence. So if we're going to use a photograph, that's a lot less, right, today things could be tampered with and all that, but it's a lot less of a clear sign than DNA. DNA is something that's a lot more, perhaps a lot more reliable. So that was one point. Second point that was discussed, which is in the second bullet, is about, are we allowed to, it's actually the third and the second should be switched, are we allowed to rely on non-Jewish testimony, right? So records, dental records, things like that. So the question becomes, or like the airlines, right, that somebody was a passenger on that airplane. Now, what would be a reason to say not? So the Gemara already discusses this, and the Gemara has this whole discussion about we can't really trust the non-Jewish authorities because maybe they're going to lie. And they're not going to tell the truth. And they're going to say that somebody really died when they weren't dead. For whatever reason, they may have their own reasons for that. Be that as it may, the Gemara seems to say we shouldn't trust non-Jews for their testimony. So how do we get around this? Things changed in society. So number one, there's a concept called Mesiach Lefi Tumo, which means someone just speaking, and they're not saying it in the form of testimony, that counts. So you just say, just speaking, that's kind of straight talk. And then there's what you might call professional capacity. So someone's professional job is to work in a coroner's office. That's their job, right? They have codes and they have rules, and if they lie, they're in a lot of trouble. So because of their professional capacity, we're actually allowed to trust them. So that's exactly what's going on, what they used in these cases in the World Trade Center and he talks about it here, how they went to the coroner, they went to the medical examiner, they went in there and they saw their operation. Rabbi Willig, if you know who he is, Rosh Yeshiva and Yeshiva University, he was impressed by the professionalism of the office, so on and so forth. And then they also found that the dental records, they went over them at least five times in each case. And he talks about the American Airlines, if you look in that third bullet. So he says that they also have a professional reputation to uphold and thus may be trusted according to halacha. So there's no apparent reason for American Airlines to lie about such a matter. It only serves to increase their exposure liability for the passenger's death.
It's true for the women, too. The same.
But what the evidence that we're trying to find for... like I said before, the evidence that we would be trying to find to verify anyone's death is going to be more strict when it comes to finding out if the husband was no longer alive than if the wife was no longer alive. But the same rules would apply And we don't use the word aguna for a husband whose wife has passed away, and we're not sure if she's passed away or not, right? Because he's not chained to her, like the word means. He's technically could get married to somebody else. We just don't allow it because of the cheirem. So it just has a different status to it. But the same kind of research was done equally in both directions. Now, that's when you have records, right? That's when you have something to go on, dental records, or DNA. In the fourth point, he talks about where there's no remains at all. So what are some other ways that they could find out? So there's something called Mayim She'en Lahem Sof, which could be just like an ocean, basically, water that has no boundary. So in this case, when the Gemara discusses it, this is a case where maybe the person got saved. Maybe they went downriver and they ended up, I don't know, getting rescued by a boat or grabbing onto a branch or something. We don't know, and we're never going to be able to find out, at this point at least. Maybe down the line, the person will come back and they'll still be alive. So the question becomes, if we have even a small little chance, which is a minority, it's a very, 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 very small minority that the person could survive. Right, if there's strong waves and whatever, and you see the person getting washed away in the waves, what's the chances that person's going to survive? The halacha treats it as what we call miyud hamatsui, which is a significant minority, that they could actually be saved. So what do you do? So, you know, in these cases, they said, like, okay, let's say the husband was on the phone with his wife while it was, like, right when it was it happened already, and he was like there in the building, and he's calling, and he's on the floor above where the planes hit. So there, it's like you know that person's not going to survive that. The person's not going to survive that. So there, you wouldn't have a doubt about whether that person's alive or not anymore. But if the husband had called his wife like before he went to work that morning, all you know is that he was on his way to work. You don't know that he was in the building. You don't have any proof. Again, it's likely that he went there. So they use something that they would call, he brings this here, he talks about chazaka, right? Let's say every single day, that's what this person does. He has a job, 9 to 5. He has to show up, whoever they are, has to show up at that place from at 9 o'clock to 5 o'clock. So that's called a pattern. That's called a chazaka. That's like an established routine. And that established routine would perhaps be enough evidence to say that's probably where they were today. Why? Because that's where they were yesterday, and that's where they were the day before, and they've been working here for 10 years, and they've been going into work every single day to that same place. That's an established routine. So we can use the concept of the established routine as like a way to prove that that's, in fact, where they were. The analogy that he gives at the end of that bullet is like an Eruv. If they tell you that the Eruv is kosher from before Shabbat, so even if something might happen to the Eruv on Shabbat, if you don't hear about it, you don't know about it, you can assume that the Erev continues to be kosher to use throughout the Shabbat. So something that's like an established pattern from the start allows us to, that's like a halachic concept that allows us to, and then they had, you know, they used the metro cards. He talks about elevator records. Obviously, it's a very, very difficult topic to even think about, but the way in which, you know, this evidence was used in DNA, which we're going to see in a moment, isn't necessarily as accepted by everyone, was something that was used to help these women in a lot of these cases, which of course was very tragic. And in the end, for many of these women, they were able to, I think they resolved all of the cases from what I recall, based on all the different evidence that they found. So, is there a basis for using science, scientific experimentation, or scientific research, or scientific data, to solve a crime or solve a Jewish issue of halacha? So, let's look at this case in source number 2. This seems to be the kind of the source case for the whole discussion. It's a story that came to Rav Saadia Gaon. Heard of Rav Saadia Gaon? And this story was related by Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid in a book called Sefer HaChassidim. Basically, what happened in a nutshell is a man goes away on a business trip. He's with his servant. His wife is at home. His wife is pregnant. And the man dies on the trip. And he never makes it back. And now the servant takes over the money and the, the house and all the, and he says, I'm the son. He says, I'm the true heir of this person. And he basically is lying, but he's claiming that he is. And then this child is born, right? This child is born. That was a child that this man had fathered. And then years later, the child finds out that he had a father and he had all this, inheritance. So now he comes and he says, I want my inheritance. I'm the true child. So how could they prove it? Is there a way to prove it? So they came to Rav Sadia Gaon and he did a blood test. So what was his blood test? We'll read it in here, I'll tell you exactly what he did. If you look in the fifth line, Tziva Rav Sadia Lahakiz Dam. So they drew blood from the son and they drew blood from the servant. And they put one blood into one cup and one in the other one. And they took a bone. You'll tell me if this sounds scientifically possible. They took a bone from the father. I don't know. Maybe they dug it up. However, they figured it out. They put it into the cup of the servant's blood. Nothing happened. The blood wasn't absorbed by the bone. Then they took the bone and put it into the cup of the son. So does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so the blood was absorbed into the bone when it was the son's blood. And he used that as a proof to award the son the money from the inheritance. So this gets into the question of exhuming a body, number one, or like autopsies, right, for purposes. Maybe. You know, it's definitely complex. It's not a blah black and white that we're just going to dig up a body just for that. But it could be that, you know, when we're talking about a person being able to get their inheritance, maybe, you know, he seems to have thought, I don't know if they, I'm assuming they buried the body, they didn't have the bones lying around. So they have to get access to it somehow. So the question becomes, you know, how legitimate is this concept of using this kind of scientific research, which isn't, there's no witnesses. This isn't, you know, we in Judaism we're very much strict about witnesses and all of that. So that doesn't work. So there's some who didn't like this. If you look in source number three, the Rivash, who was living just a little bit after Rav Yehuda Chassid, he said we shouldn't reach decisions regarding the laws of our Torah and its commands based on the scholars of science and medicine, because if we trust their words, there's no Torah from heaven, God forbid, for we do not rely upon science and medicine. Instead, we rely on Chazal, sages, even if they say that right is left, for they have the right to the truth, the interpretations of the law, one person for the next, back to Moshe Rabbeinu. So that's kind of one approach, which is Torah is Torah, and if there's no source in the halacha that this is the way that we find out information to help us, then even if science is perfect and accurate and great, we're not going to rely on it. Question becomes, you know, what if it doesn't go against the halacha, but it is something that's, you know, the science helps us find out something that the Torah wouldn't, that the science, that the Chazal didn't talk about, the rabbis didn't talk about in the Talmud or in the halacha. So perhaps he wouldn't necessarily disagree in a case where you wouldn't be able to find it out otherwise. And there were many, of course, who did support this. Like Rav Yitzhak Herzog, who was a very important rabbinic figure in the early years of, after the establishment of the State of Israel. He says here in source number four, how is it relevant to speak of the reliability of physicians when it comes to something that is definitely accepted by all the greatest medical scholars throughout the world? What a vast difference there is between the medical science in their times, time of the rabbis, and in our times. It's a shame that while science is continually breaking new ground, revealing deep secrets, even if it's occasionally mistaken, we in regard to scientific matters that are relevant to the sacred Torah bury our heads in the sand. He's obviously not so happy about anyone who was around him who was rejecting not experimental science, but science that that is proven in very, very strong and supported ways through in the medical community. So at the same time, Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, who wrote Tshuvot Tzitz Eliezer, 20th century, many, big, big posek in Israel. He did not like Rav Saadia's idea because he's basically saying that we're going to figure out biological relationship of a son to a father based on this blood test. So he uses a Gemara, which I don't know if you've heard this Gemara before. It's somewhat of a well-known Gemara. He says there are three partners in creating a person. It's a Gemara Masechet Nida. If you look in the third line, Yesh v'adam ha-kadosh baruch hu avi v'imo. The father gives certain biological properties to the child, the mother gives certain biological properties to the child, and God gives the soul. Right? So what are the properties that the father gives? What are the properties that the mother gives? He assumes, and although it doesn't say blood anywhere in this, it uses the word odem, which many commentaries understand odem just because it sounds like the word adom, which is like red, doesn't necessarily mean blood. And then he says you can't use a blood test to verify the status of a son to a father. You might be able to use it for a son to a mother because the blood comes from the mother. He's assuming that that's what this Gemara is saying. Now, I don't know if any of this is biologically the right way, but many did not like his argument. And the reason is because this is not a halachic Gemara. This is what we call like an Agadah, right? Maybe it's true, maybe it's not true. The rabbis weren't necessarily saying it as a statement of halacha. They were saying it as a statement of, Jewish philosophy or Jewish thought about birth and about, you know, labor and conception of a child. So some basically looked at this and said, I'm not sure that this is a good proof against using this kind of test. And some looked at it and said, yeah, that's what the Gemara says. It goes against the rabbis. You can't do a blood test like that. Nevertheless, leaving all of that aside, we see from the World Trade Center kind of issue or discussion that using data from science is pretty widely accepted. So we're just not sure how and when this DNA can be used. So let's just talk a little bit about some of these questions. So are you allowed to use DNA to determine whether a child was born from the right mother? Right, or the right father, for example. We're talking here about mamzer, right? The issue of a child being born out of a natural marriage. So there's a Gemara that has a very interesting application to this. It's in source 6. So it was a man who heard his wife saying to her daughter, it's a Gemara in Bava Metzia, why do you not act clandestinely, which means quietly, right, when you engage in forbidden sexual intercourse? So that woman, he's pointing, he's saying, me, his wife, I have 10 sons, and I have only one from your father, and no one knows. So you too should be careful so that no one will discover your behavior. So having overheard that only one son was his, when the man was dying, he said to all of his family, all of my property is left to one son. Right? Even though there were 10, he's saying there was only one who was his true son, but they didn't know which one of them it was, who he was giving it to. So they went to a rabbi, his name is Rabbi Bena'a. They went for guidance, and he said to the sons, go strike your father's grave until he rises and reveals to you which of you he left his property to. They all went, but that one who was his son didn't go. So Rabbi Bena'a said to them, all the property belongs to this son who did not go. So you wonder yourself, what kind of a rabbinic decision is that? Right? That seems to be completely against all of our regular functioning of how we prove something to be true. So the Rashbam in source number 7, he says that Rabbi Bena'a used something called Shuda de Dine. Shuda de Dine is what we call discretionary judgment. Discretionary judgment, you're issuing that in absence of true evidence. In other words, just because son number 10 didn't participate doesn't necessarily prove that he's actually the son. Yet, he's... what's he doing? He's saying, he's awarding him the inheritance based on discretion. So the Rashash, in source number 8, he brings this question that was asked by a number of the later commentaries. And they say, well, why didn't he just do the blood test? Right? Why didn't he just use Rav Sa'adi? What's the word? Anachronistic? It's 1,000 years later, right? Rav Sa'adi Gaon is living in 900. This is the time of the Gemara. So he's saying, why didn't he use the blood test that the guy used 900 years in the future to figure out what relation, whether this son was really related or not? So he answers that the reason is because we try very hard not to call out people as not being born from that parent. We don't want to create mamzers. We don't want to tell people that they are a mamzer. So even if we could figure it out, we try to avoid it. So DNA may work against a person in this sense. So a lot of the postgame said we don't want to use DNA to establish a status of mamzer. But what comes out of it is that science is usable, is worthy, is valuable as evidence to establish status. And the reason we're not doing it in this case is just because we don't want, it's bad PR, it's bad, you know. And that was actually a real case that came to Rav Eliashiv, who was just passed away a few years ago. He was dealing with a case where somebody wanted to verify, use DNA to verify if the daughter was really the daughter. And he said, you're not allowed to do the test. Because if you find out that she's not the daughter, then you might have to use that evidence, and then we have a mamzer problem on our hands. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, well, don't we want to know? Right? That's like, it goes in both directions. Right? Wouldn't we want to know if someone is, you know, really the child of that marriage? But the Gemara and Chazal seem to work very hard to avoid it. The Gemara in Yevamot, this is in source 10, the Gemara in Yevamot has this case where a husband goes overseas. Now, 12-month gestation, that's basically what this Gemara is about. I don't know what you think about that. The baby was in the mother's womb for 12 months in this case. So basically what happened was the husband goes overseas, the baby's delayed, and then the child is born, right? But the child is born 12 months later. He's been gone, right? He's been gone for 12 months, and everybody says, well, whose child is it? So the rabbi in that case, his name was Rava Tosvaha, if you can see it in the second line. He says the child is the child of this father, the one who was away. How could that be? Husband is presumed to be the father. Child's not a mamzer. In other words, if he's away 12 months, either his child is not his child, because that's too long for a baby to be in a mother's womb, or he is the child, but now we're dealing with a strange medical, you know, reality where a woman was pregnant for 12 months. So the Gemara goes through this whole kind of back and forth to explain how it might be possible that it could happen. It's a very, 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 very minority case, but it could happen. And this Gemara is kind of the paradigm for, look how far we go to try to avoid establishing someone's status as a mamzer. So in that case, it doesn't mean that DNA is thrown out. It just means that we're not going to use it because we're very careful. So that's the Rivash says it as well in Source 11. So that's what the law would be when it comes to mamzer. What if the woman was known to be, promiscuous, or people knew that she wasn't such a faithful woman to her husband, or whatever it was? Then it would be different. Then we would use it against her. Maybe we would use it to really prove, because we would be a little bit more suspicious. But all these things obviously are very sensitive.
But it's, I mean, from like a meta-halachic perspective, yeah, they can't actually say, we really don't want there to be a mom's there, so we're going to pretend that it's 12 months. They can't say that, right? But like, that is what they're doing.
Yeah, that is what they're doing, yeah. It's halach and shulchan aruch. Look in source 12. During the 12 months, however, there's no concern. Well, I guess it did happen. There must have been precedent. There must have been precedent for this kind of thing. As hard as it is to wrap our heads around it, I never heard of it before, but it doesn't mean it didn't happen. And the discussion continues in other areas as well. Let's wrap it up. So in the what do we do when we come to a court and we want to use the DNA to help people get their money back or other kinds of civil cases? So in source 15, 16, this is all discussion. You bring something that's the evidence itself, almost like what you call, the Gemara calls it balo hargo, or glove. So someone comes into the Beis Din, into the Jewish court, and says, I saw X kill Y. And we saw Y, you know, they give all their proof that Y is no longer alive, and then Y walks in. The person that they said was just murdered walks in himself or herself, shows up at the court. So what happens to those? What happens to that testimony? So the Gemara says in 16 that the testimony is thrown out because this is the strongest evidence that you could have against, you know, in any case where the person that said that person was murdered is basically going to be is alive and is saying, I'm here, that person will end up being able to undo whatever testimony was there, which I guess would work against someone who's convicted of murder, right? And I feel like there are cases of this that have happened before, where people were wrong, not only wrongly accused of murder because they weren't the murderer, but they didn't act, there was actually never a murder that took place. You know, I'm sure it's happened before. Have to go look it up. Question becomes, what do you do when you have DNA versus witnesses? Like, which one wins, right? You have two people that say X, and you have DNA that says something else. So there, you probably can't beat the witnesses.
Why not?
Because there would be like a case of what we said earlier, where the Torah says we rely on witnesses, and there was never a discussion about being able to use other sorts of evidence that would trump it. Witnesses have like the highest status. That's what the Rambam says in 17, Hilchot Sanhedrin. He says it also in Sefer Mitzvot. Again, they have to see it, right? They have to have been witness to a crime. They can't just say we know about something that happened. We know about something that happened would probably be weaker than DNA.
Isn't
right?
it? It's a kind of testimony in itself, the DNA.
Right.
It's like if you're a doctor, whatever, you're looking at the DNA, like you're witnessing.
Right.
Clear.
So the question is, what is it? Right. So that's the last thing I want to talk about. This is source 18, Rav Asher Weiss. It's also a very prominent halachic authority in Israel today. So the first thing he says is he doesn't believe that DNA has a status of edut, of testimony. And he brings the Rambam twice in Hilchot Yesod HaTorah, says that we do not believe edim, witnesses, because we know they are correct. It doesn't work just because you have that evidence. Then he says, I do not think that DNA is an umdana. An umdana is circumstantial evidence. But he actually does believe, like I said earlier, it's a siman muvhak. It's a clear sign. So the principle is that it is totally unreasonable that two objects would have precisely the same features. Like we said, it's one in whatever the number, quintillion, some crazy thing that somebody else would have the same DNA as somebody else. And then he writes, I think witnesses would override a siman muvhak because they are sufficient for everything. The only thing that overrides them is the case that I said, where a person walks in, baharugal raglav, biraglav, he walks in and he says, I'm alive, even though the witnesses came and said, I'm no longer alive, that will override the witnesses. So he says, sometimes we will use DNA, and sometimes we won't, and it depends kind of on the case. But that seems to be how the system, whether it fits with your understanding of it or not, that is definitely how the system was set up. His opinion, there's other approaches to this, but he looks at it as testimony is all about what you see with your eyes. And he feels that even though DNA is something that is seen, I don't know how you call it, visible, whatever the terminology would use, testable, it doesn't have the same power as seeing an act with your own eyes. So he sees it as something that's on a lower level. It doesn't mean that he doesn't believe that we can use it. He believes we could use it. He would just kind of question when we would and when we wouldn't. And then at the end, I just thought this is to include this. He talks about, you know, how challenging it is, and you just imagine being somebody who would have to make decisions about these issues. Right? We're talking about it after the fact, after, you know, a tragedy like the World Trade Center or other issues that have come up, and we're not the ones who are going to have to make these decisions. But if you were in that seat, it would be very difficult. So he says it's a great challenge to paskin sheilot in our changing world to decide halachic issues, and we need to begin every day with a tefillah to Hashem, shelo nikashel bidvar halacha. We shouldn't stumble when it comes to halachic matters. We should always be zocha to raise Torah and to be mekadesh shem shemaim. Okay. Questions?